Welcome to episode 19 of the Steptoe Cyber Law Podcast, brought to you by Steptoe & Johnson. Thank you for joining us. We're lawyers talking about technology, security, privacy, and government. And I'm joined today by Michael Vadas, formerly with the FBI and the Justice Department, now a partner in Steptoe's New York office. Jason Weinstein is with his daughter celebrating her birthday in preschool, I believe. So he will not be joining us, but we do have a great guest commentator today. Chris Painter is the coordinator at the State Department for cyber issues, somebody I've known probably for 20 or 30 years in cybersecurity. He has been at the computer crime and intellectual property section, an effective international spokesman for the U.S. Position. Welcome, Chris.
Thank you. Good to see you.
And I am Stuart Baker, formerly with the NSA and DHS, and returning to Steptoe for the umpteenth time to practice law. Let's get started. We traditionally do This Week in NSA, a feature that is on its last legs since the press is running out of mean things to say about NSA. And as witness to that, I will have to give the award early this month for the dumbest NSA story of the month, as Al Jazeera announces that it has an exclusive emails reveal close Google relationship with NSA, and then proceeds to reveal that NSA was invited to a meeting to talk about a set of cybersecurity problems that NSA and the Defense Department had identified, and that one member of Google's top management went, and then when invited to another meeting, Eric Schmidt said, "Ah, sorry, I've got a conflict, can't go." Out of that, Al Jazeera tries to make a story. You can read it. I defy you to tell me what it's about, other than that they had a Freedom of Information Act request and they got three or four really boring emails in which Google politely turned down or accepted opportunities to hear from NSA about cybersecurity issues. Congratulations, Al Jazeera. You are the first non-Glenn Greenwald associated media to win Dumbest NSA Story of the Month. Other stories about NSA, pretty slim. Probably the most interesting is that the USA Freedom Act has been consolidated in the House. There were two competing bills, one coming out of the Judiciary Committee, one coming out of the Intelligence Committee in the House. It was setting the stage for a pretty rough and, from the point of view of the Republican leadership, quite divisive battle over exactly what bill would go to the floor. Now it appears that the judiciary bill has gotten a significant haircut and has been adopted by both the intelligence and the judiciary committees, but there's considerable uncertainty about exactly what and when will come to the floor. What I'm hearing is that this bill is still more of a placeholder than the actual bill that the House leadership is going to bring to the floor, and that's not surprising that this is an issue that has divided the Tea Party Republicans, divided other Republicans, and also divides Democrats. My bet is that the leadership is going to force the Judiciary and the Intelligence Committee chairs to sit down and work through this draft pretty carefully, probably with some input from the administration, which surprisingly has not decided to score points with this bill, but is actually working with the Republican leadership to some degree to come up with a bill that might pass and that the administration could support. So I'm not going to get into the details of that. The only other NSA point worth mentioning is I actually did do a post over the weekend for Volok Conspiracy asking whether Snowden is a spy. There was a Wall Street Journal article strongly suggesting that he had taken so much military stuff and so little civil liberties stuff that it was done for espionage purposes. And my suggestion is that maybe it was done for personal protection. That is to say, he intended to trade these military secrets to whoever gave him protection. A view that is kind of confirmed by the way he started out talking about all the stuff he knew about NSA's attacks on China, and then has stopped talking about that almost entirely, and instead is releasing stories that are mostly useful to Russia's geopolitical strategies. But we don't know for sure. It's just an interesting speculation. I am struck reading the comments to that note that this is an issue on which Snowden is slowly losing air and altitude. When he first came out, everybody thought he was wonderful, and now there is a very sharp divide between commenters who think that he's a spy and those who think that he's still a hero. In FTC news, LabMD is showing signs of life. It managed to force the FTC or get an order saying that the FTC would have to disclose something about its security standards. Rather than talk about that ourselves, I thought it might be useful to ask the CEO of LabMD, who has been fighting this case, if he would come on the show and give us his views. And so, without further ado, let's talk to Michael Daugherty, the CEO of LabMD.
So you've announced that you've won a victory over the FTC, a preliminary victory. Can you tell me what it is and where you're going to go from here?
Well, just the fact that it's been acknowledged by some aspect of the administrative regulatory system that the Federal Trade Commission has got to disclose some degree of their standards is a victory. We keep proper perspective of the administrative system because we understand fully that the judge could rule for us and the commissioners could just flip it, as they've done in many others. So it was their choice to go this route first before we get to the federal courts. And so, I think we have a pretty healthy attitude about what our odds are in being victorious in this round, which we consider very slim. But still, to have the ALJ say that is a good thing.
Okay. What you're hoping to do, I think, is ask the $64,000 question. What security standard was the FTC using that required that LabMD have protection against misuse of file sharing programs like LimeWire? Is that right?
Well, I think that's even way more specific than our question. Our question is, what are the standards and rules, period? And they say they don't have to promulgate rules, and they say they don't have to have standards in their briefs, and it makes it very difficult for people, especially in medicine, to know exactly what we're supposed to do. It allows the type of witch hunt that they've gone on to assert their jurisdiction, and it's just backwards. So it also, makes a mistake or an error from people's perspective 6 years later look like negligence or that we weren't up to standards. And quite frankly, that's why we're asking these questions, because it is very difficult in 2014 to roll your head back to 2006, 2008. And that's exactly why we have to have standards and we have to have input from other areas of the country, not just, the Federal Trade Commission. In the HHS side, as HIPAA developed, there was a lot of input from the healthcare community, and we've seen none of that from the Federal Trade Commission. And that really is the crux of our problem. We've been asking this question from the very beginning. What did we do wrong? What were we supposed to do right? They never will answer the question. All they do is put consent decrees in front of you that have been signed by other companies that we all know have buckled just to make the FTC go away, that have also signed where they say no admission of wrongdoing is acknowledged. And they're using these to try to build common law, which we consider extremely underhanded, excuse me, and not going to work in a business environment and also in an environment that's changing so incredibly rapidly. I mean, it's like the Federal Trade Commission wants to catch light in a jar. You just can't, it's not going to be effective in the big picture either. So, yeah, they never answer the question.
So, in the end, where is this case going, and especially where is the company going? Is LabMD still in business?
The company had stopped accepting specimens. We have let everyone go. I have just myself as the only employee and one volunteer because we're required by law to have the records available to the physicians and patients for 5 to 10 years, depending on the record, because we do diagnose cancer. So we have tissue slides and all sorts of testing records. And then we still have accounts receivable. We're winding down. So is it still an entity? Yes. Is it still a corporation? Yes. Has it been dissolved? No. Has it filed bankruptcy? No. Is it an operating laboratory right now? No.
So for other people who are facing these kinds of consent decree offers from the FTC, it seems to me that the lesson that people are going to learn from this is, yes, you can fight it, but you'll be out of business by the time you get to court.
Well, it really depends on the industry. I mean, you know, we're in medicine, and back in 08 to 10, keep in mind, you know, Snowden, Assange, WikiLeaks, these were not in the populist lexicon. Today, if you talk to most surgeons and say FTC, they're not going to know what you're talking about. They'll know Health and Human Services, they'll know HHS, but they're not going to know FTC. So, but if you look at, I'm not begrudging people that sign consent decrees because, honestly, I've having spoken to enough business people, I think people have contempt for the Federal Trade Commission as far as being judicial or fair, and it's considered a business decision to get as far away as fast as possible. And the downside of the consent decree doesn't impact their business negatively. Whereas I am diagnosing cancer, and I am going to get a reputation tainted with practitioners that we don't keep our data safe. That was a death knell. That was not going to work. In other industries, it might be a smart business move. So I'm not begrudging people that sign consent decrees. I am begrudging the Federal Trade Commission using consent decrees as setting an example of what we should know what to do. It's unfair. If nothing else, there's no notice and there's no due process so far. And that's what I'm trying to show.
Okay. Well, Michael Daugherty, thank you very much for coming on and giving us your perspective on the case. And we look forward to hearing how the litigation plays out. Thank you very much.
All right. That was interesting. Let's move on to other legal developments. Probably the biggest story from a tech point of view, although I'm not sure what its impact is going to be on government policy, is the Federal Circuit decision in the lawsuit between Oracle and Google over Google's copying of a set of APIs Oracle had released all of the code under an open source license, but had kept control of the APIs for the code and claimed copyright in those. The judge below had said, you can't copy an API, I'm sorry. And the Federal Circuit has just reversed, saying, yes, you can. Michael, have you looked at this?
I have. It's an interesting opinion. It's a complicated and long decision. But essentially, the Federal Circuit held that even though an API or the source code for an API serves a function, it is still copyrightable, and it is separate, the expression of the idea is separate from the idea that's contained within that code, and therefore it's copyrightable. The court remanded, though, for determination of whether Google's use of the APIs in Android operating system constituted fair use, and so it was not an infringement of Oracle's copyright. So there's still a big fight that remains, and I think we'll see really all of the tech industry get engaged on that issue, just as they were engaged through amicus briefs on the issue of whether the APIs were copyrightable in the first place.
Yeah, I think it is a big surprise and can kind of inconsistent with the way techies have approached these in the past. They've assumed that APIs, which are really just sort of names for protocols, are not copyrightable, sort of in the same way that the titles of books are not copyrightable. They're sort of obvious, and if you could copyright one, people would run out of titles pretty fast. So this is kind of a surprise, and consistent with the Federal Circuit's reputation as particularly protective of intellectual property.
Yeah, I think it's, I think this decision is likely to stick. I don't see a very great chance of Supreme Court review, though, of course, we'll have to see. And we'll have to see if it gets up there, even depending on what happens on the fair use issue below.
Well, you almost never get conflicts because the Federal Circuit has sole jurisdiction of these appeals, if I remember right.
Yeah, I think the basis for cert eventually would be that this is just such an important issue that the court should take it on that ground.
Yeah. A literary touch, I think Google had argued, give me a break, these APIs, they might be something as simple as the word max, right? Not even maximum. But you type in max and that leads to a particular routine, and then you specify the two numbers that you want to have compared to decide which is bigger than the other. Google had said, you know, it's a three-letter word. How can they copyright it? And the judge said, cited Dickens' Tale of Two Cities. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. And said, those are all short words, and those are copyrighted too.
Right, because it's not just the single word that's copyrighted. It's the whole compendium of them and the way in which they were arranged. The court found that Oracle could have written the declaring code for the APIs, you know, in many hundreds of different ways. And so, as a result, the expression that they chose for those words was copyrightable.
Do you agree with me that it's hard to see a big policy element to this outside of the arguments that will be made to the courts about whether this is good policy or bad? I just don't see Washington getting involved in it.
I don't. I mean, and the other thing that's interesting always about software industry and patents is that every company is on both sides of this issue. They're prosecuting patents, they're defending against infringement cases at the same time for other technology. So, I think that fact alone is going to mean that Congress isn't going to be motivated heavily on one side or the other to jump in.
Yeah, I did see a story already in which somebody said, Oracle copied my APIs without my permission. If they're copyrightable, maybe Oracle has a problem. So you're right. There's likely to be actions on both sides of this. Pretty thin here. New York has put out a report, kind of a humdrum report about bank security that reveals that, you know, big banks often have better security in some ways than small banks. And nothing particularly interesting in the report other than the statement that the New York State intends to start auditing banks' cybersecurity, or at least inspecting, using cybersecurity when they do inspections, which is probably a good thing. And maybe if they start using some of the same questions that the SEC has been using, we'll start to see a de facto emergence of standards. What else? Oh, Facebook and Zynga got a, yes?
No, I was going to mention that ACLU FOIA case.
Oh, yeah. I love this case. I love this case because it's like the ACLU is saying, well, I'm sorry, just because you were declared, found innocent or not guilty in a crime doesn't mean you have privacy rights. You have the same privacy rights that guilty people have, and which is none in our argument. And the Justice Department is arguing for the privacy rights of acquitted defendants. This is a very odd case.
Yeah, this is a lineup, usually don't see. What happened here was that the ACLU sued the government under FOIA seeking information or records about cases in which the government had used cellular phone tracking data that was obtained without a warrant. And the D.C. Circuit had ruled a couple of years ago that information could be disclosed with regard to people who had been convicted. And this is just the case names and the docket numbers for these prosecutions. So the court held that even though people who had been convicted had some privacy rights, those rights were not great since they'd been convicted, and they were outweighed by the interest in public disclosure of that information because of the whole ongoing debate about whether you actually should require a warrant to get cell phone tracking data.
Well, and probably isn't this also the interest of the ACLU and plaintiffs' lawyers in assembling a class of plaintiffs for the next lawsuit?
Well, I suppose there's that too, but there is, you know, I don't deny that there is certainly a strong public interest in this issue, I think. But then the interesting part came with that the ACLU is saying that people who were prosecuted but acquitted or the case was dismissed don't have a great privacy right in that information because all that information can be gotten through a Google search or a docket search on Pacer. And so that information should be disclosed as well. And the court said, no, people who are acquitted or have their case dismissed do have a greater privacy right than those convicted because, you know, they have an interest in repose and getting on with their lives and they don't need more attention being drawn to the fact that they were once suspected by the government. Oh, and maybe we're actually guilty, but, you know, the government didn't meet its burden of proof. So it's interesting that the ACLU was more interested here in public disclosure than they were in the privacy rights of people who ultimately were acquitted.
So maybe that should be the ACLU's new motto. We'll protect your privacy against the government, but don't get in our way. Okay, another piece of litigation. Facebook and Zynga got a reprieve. The Court of Appeals declared that they could not be sued for failing to follow their what was claimed was that they had disclosed information about their subscribers in ways that were not disclosed by the terms of service, and wiretap cases were brought against them. And the court said, I'm sorry, that's not a wiretap because you're not disclosing the content of communications. Boy, I would have thought that was pretty clear. So the only lawsuit that can go forward under these terms of service cases are claims under state law for breach of contract, which to my mind has to be a near total defeat for the plaintiff's lawyer because they're going to have enormous difficulty showing damages and especially showing damages that are the same for all members of the class, which means that they can bring these lawsuits one by one for some indeterminate amount of damages arising from the disclosure of modest amounts of information or maybe, you know, in some cases more than modest amounts of information. So it sounds like like that case is not going anywhere. Speaking of cases that, well, actually in this case, it did go somewhere, the Snapchat case. We talked to Michael Daugherty about the FTC's claim against him, which was based on LimeWire. This is a case against Snapchat for promising your communications will disappear and then not actually making sure that they did. So if there's a going to be a class action. I think Anthony Weiner is going to probably join it. Michael, did you follow that?
I did. This is a standard case brought by the FTC when it finds that a company's marketing claims or privacy policy are deceptive. In this case, Snapchat basically markets itself as a way to send photos and videos, which are called snaps, that are ephemeral. That is, when you send them, you can designate how long that the recipient will be allowed to view them before it just disappears. And the FTC found that, in fact, there are ways to circumvent its technology so that the recipient could capture the image and keep it. There was also a finding by the FTC that that users' information was not kept securely by the company if it failed to build adequate security measures into the app and things like that. So nothing remarkable here. There wasn't a finding under the unfairness prong. It was just that the company was deceptive in the way it marketed its app.
But as usual with the FTC these days, they're sort of saying, if you're a tech company and you if you screw up in any way and we have you over a barrel, we're going to extract a 20-year agreement in which you have to have an independent privacy professional auditing your privacy practices. I mean, that's becoming pretty much standard, isn't it?
Yeah, that's absolutely standard. There's a requirement for a biennial audit of your privacy practices and your compliance with the order. But at least Snapchat didn't have to pay anything here, so they got away. I mean, that's the usual distinction. If it wasn't really bad, then you don't have to pay any money into the FTC's coffers.
I guess that's right. And the alternative, obviously, is to be where Michael Daugherty is, which is, from Snapchat's point of view, deeply unattractive. But I have to say, you know, if I were taking bets, I would not be betting that 20 years from now, Snapchat's going to be around in its current incarnation.
Yeah, we'll be sending holograms to each other, which, you know, I think by definition are ephemeral.
Let's hope so. God. Okay. That's the news for the week. And now I really will begin talking to Chris Painter about the role that I still think of as his new role. He's probably been doing it, what, 5 years now?
Three,
okay. As coordinator on cyber issues at the State Department, what does your office do? Why was it created? And what do you do from day to day?
So back, you know, as you said, Stuart, I've had a long history in this area. I was a prosecutor at one point. I was a justice. I was at the White House, and then I came to state. And particularly when I was at the White House helping both with the cyberspace policy review and then the international strategy, the president's international strategy for cyberspace, it was clear that this is becoming more and more these issues, this basket of cyber issues, which I'll talk about in a moment, are becoming more and more not just a technical imperative or a legislative imperative, but an international policy imperative.
Oh, absolutely.
And indeed, when you think about cyber issues, which many people, I think, still code as being very technical, there are core issues involved of economic policy, of security policy, and of human rights policy. So this is something that's important to all the stuff we're doing internationally. Also, I think you and I and Mike have all seen that cyber is sort of the new black, and it's like everywhere. There's constant movement in this area, and that's no less true internationally, with almost every international forum or bilateral relationship paying more attention to it. So it's not that the State Department hadn't been doing work in this area, but they've been work in different various silos of excellence. So you had people doing some of the internet governance work and the economic issues. You had people doing some of the law enforcement issues. You had people doing telecom and hard security issues. But it really wasn't married up even within the department, let alone within the interagency and across the U.S. government. And as we saw, this is becoming an emerging real priority, as former Secretary Clinton said, that these issues in cyberspace have become a new foreign policy imperative for the U.S. My office was created in the Secretary's office of the Department of State to do two things. One, to really up our game internationally and make sure that we were unifying our policy across all these different buckets of activities. whether it be from internet freedom issues to the economic and governance issues to the cybercrime issues to cybersecurity due diligence, as I call it, you know, getting countries to adopt national strategies and to cooperate more in their policies and having institutions like CERTS, to the hard international security issues, international law, confidence building measures, and others. I mean, having all of those things which are interrelated come together, and for us, not just the State Department, but our whole interagency, work more internationally to promote the vision that's in the International Strategy for Cyberspace of an open, interoperable, secure and reliable information and communications infrastructure built on norms of behavior. So my office started now. We just celebrated our third-year anniversary back in February. I actually moved over from the White House to the State Department on my birthday and then got on a plane to some foreign destination that day. We started with about 4 people. We have about 16 now, including some people who are fellows, including some people who have very good technical expertise and policy expertise. And we really work across our building with all the different parts of our building and across the interagency to promote the U.S. vision, and we believe the right vision of cyberspace is open, interoperable, but secure environment.
We should probably give a shout-out to the Steptoe alumnus who's part of your office, Teddy Nemiroff, who's here with you. He's in your office on a Council on Foreign Relations internship.
Right? He is, and Teddy's been a great help in the time he's been there so far, and has been a real contributor to all of our efforts, so really appreciate that. And Obviously, institutions like the Council on Foreign Relations and others have recognized the foreign policy dimension of these issues.
So,
I should mention, you know, as I talk about these different buckets of activity, those really are our key priorities. And there are different priorities within each of those different buckets, but they all do interrelate to some extent.
Yeah, although I've been struck by the fact that if you're an authoritarian state, security is a lot easier. You want to be able to attribute and punish misbehaviors inside your territory and outside it in exactly the same way. Whereas if you come from a democratic tradition, there's an inclination to say, well, we need to be able to gather information on the people who are attacking us, but we also see the value of anonymity. And so it does seem to me that in some ways it's easier from a technical point of view to be arguing the authoritarian state side than rather than the democratic side.
Well, I mean, easier, but will lead to, I think, a development of the internet that would be far less robust in terms of not just social issues, which are obviously targeted there, but even economic growth and innovation that the internet's allowed to really promote it over the last number of years. And we see this debate where there are some more repressive countries who even use a different terminology. So we talk about cybersecurity. They talk about information security. We talk about protecting networks. They talk about destabilizing information on the internet. They talk about sovereignty that extends, that they can exercise sovereignty over the internet at their borders and control what's there. And we argue for a far more open platform for information. And I think the key there, Stuart, is this is an active debate. There are many countries who understand the benefit that the internet and communications technology has brought us, understand the economic and societal benefits. And that's one of the key things we're arguing in all these different places and in our bilateral relationships. I'd say there are also lots of countries that are frankly on the fence. There are a lot of developing and other world countries who are looking at this. They're worried about stability to some extent, but they're worried about economic prosperity and social prosperity. And that's why it's critical at this time to advance our argument, because I think it will help those societies, and I think we need to continue to promote this. And a lot of our capacity building work and other things are tied to that.
So you do capacity building, or at least you encourage capacity building and help coordinate it for countries that want to deal with cybercrime on the internet, but also want to make sure that they have a good infrastructure so that it can foster business development.
Yeah, so for instance, we've done three regional trainings in Africa, one in partnership with the government of Kenya a couple of years ago for the East African community, and then two in Western Africa regionally there. And we've worked also with the African Union in these issues. And it's beyond cybercrime. It's talking about cybercrime, cybersecurity, but we also talk about why it's important to have an open internet too. We kind of link those things together. And we're going to do more of those. And I think those are important to do around the world because and it's not just us that's doing them. We work with other countries who are also prioritizing this. The EU, the External Action Service, since we're sitting in the Brussels room here today, the External Action Service of the EU has spent a lot of time thinking about capacity building. The London process, which is a series of conferences, we just had one in Seoul, Korea, have focused on some of the capacity building issues. It's really something that not only helps prepare these countries to deal with the increasing connectivity they're getting, and they're getting new cable drops, and they're using mobile broadband more and more, but also understands the policy dimensions of this.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. And I think, you know, when you look at what has happened to mobile telephony use in Africa and what a transformative event that has been for their economy, it's as smartphones get cheaper and cheaper and you're starting to see $50 and $100, you know, bad smartphones, but still smartphones, that's only going to grow. A lot of people can afford that.
Absolutely. I mean, for instance, when we were in Kenya, they had a mobile payment service called M-Pesa, which at the time was more advanced than a lot of things we get in the U.S. And so the fact that they're leapfrogging, and they have the, I think, ability to build the right kind of structures, certs, other structures, strategies, to deal with this that and learn from our mistakes, quite frankly. As we've been growing up, we haven't always done these things right ourselves. So to learn that and to have that baked in while they're thinking about these new technologies, but also understand the larger policy dimensions of having an open platform.
So, I mean, Huawei and ZTE pretty much own the contracts for mobile systems in Africa. They've really swept the board by offering very good prices. Do you get concerns from African countries about the security from a diplomatic and national security point of view of their grid?
We you know, I won't comment on specific companies, but certainly we are seeing governments really around the world understanding all types of security threats, whether it be the external threats from intrusions, particularly intrusions that are taking intellectual property, to the possible disruption of critical infrastructure, to supply chain threats. So I think that more and more governments are seeing these things as issues. And it's often a learning process and an evolving process, and that's one of the reasons we, you know, we've both done this capacity building work. But also, you know, one of the things since my office was created, we've launched numerous bilateral dialogues with countries, and we've done those as all of government dialogues. Now, you know, you were in government, Stuart, and you know that often in government you'd meet with your counterparts and you talk your stuff, and the rest of the government on both sides would never know what the hell happened. So.
In fact, that's often the goal.
So what we've tried to do is both within our own government, but also externally, model this all-of-government approach. So when we have these dialogues, it's obviously state, but it's also our Homeland Security Department, our Justice Department, DOD, Commerce, Treasury, the full range of different countries or departments. And then from the other country side, they bring the same parties. So we just had one of these dialogues with Japan recently, and it's very helpful to have that cross-governmental discussion on both sides. And we've done this with India, we've done this with Brazil, we've done this with Germany, we're having another one with Germany fairly soon. We've done this with Korea, and a number of other countries We're looking at how we can engage in the best way possible, but those have been really helpful in moving this along.
Yeah, that I can see the value in that. Although in many cases it's just, you know, from the point of view of the U.S., they're just telling again what they do, and sometimes in a few cases these are countries who can offer their own useful contributions, but in a lot of cases this is just us saying, if you don't have an idea what to do, here's what we do.
I mean, that's part of it. I mean, part of it is to show the roadmap of kind of institutions we've built and national strategies we've done. We're not the only ones that are promoting this. For instance, within the OAS, the Organization of American States, there's been a lot of work by one of the groups there, CICTA. And I started doing this back, I'm a recovering lawyer now, but back when I was a full-time lawyer at the Justice Department, we started working with these different parts of OAS to deliver, to work on cybercrime laws, for instance. But this one part has done this national strategy building for OAS states, you know, having strategies that elevate this as a priority, but also tie all these different government entities together. So yes, it's often lessons learned from us, but it's also an evolving lessons learned from their side too. And then when you're talking about threats that we're facing and how we can collaborate on those threats, I mean, that's more operational.
Well, you know, you don't have to answer this, but I know that when the U.S. government discovers that a U.S. company has been compromised because they find their files, let's say, on a command and control server, there's a program now that's reasonably well organized where a variety of law enforcement agencies divide up responsibility and go in and talk to the company and say, by the way, you're pwned. What do you do when it's a non-U.S. company? Does the State Department have a program, or does the intelligence community have a program of going to at least our allies to say we think that certain companies have been compromised?
Well, we work, you know, we're dealing with cyber threats. We do use a number of different channels. So we use law enforcement channels. We use our CERT channels through DHS, especially when we're talking about particular vulnerabilities. And that's been done. And then we also use diplomatic channels. And so some of that can be responding to requests from foreign countries, for help. And those come in fairly often. And sometimes they're technical, and sometimes they're diplomatic, and sometimes they're on a law enforcement basis. Some of that could be us asking them for help. And as you said, there are lots of multinational companies too. So yes, we are working with foreign governments to say, how can we best share vulnerability information so that companies can protect themselves and governments can protect themselves. One thing that was interesting recently in terms of a cyber threat that we did was, you know, the widespread long-term denial of service attacks against financial institutions in the U.S. You know, normally what
these are the ones that I've attributed to Iran, but I'm not asking you to attribute them.
I'm not going to attribute them, but I'll say they clearly were an issue where you had these things. They would come and go, and they get more and more intense. And these were caused by botnets. And I'm sure most of the people in your listening audience know what botnets are, but distributed denial of service attacks compromise computers all over the world, shifting concentrations of where those computers are located. And they attack websites in the U.S. and essentially knock them online or offline or make them unavailable. Now, this is nothing that new. I prosecuted back, you know, in the day, one of the first ones of these back in the 90s. But they get more sophisticated as
time. And they get bigger, I'm sure.
They get bigger. Yeah. And so what we started doing was something that was unique. We, you know, obviously still used our CERT channels and our law enforcement channels to contact countries around the world where these things were concentrated, and you know, these were compromised computers in their areas, and asked them if they could take action. But we coupled that with a diplomatic move. We contacted a number of countries, over 20 countries, and did diplomatic démarches. Now, before I went to the State Department, I always thought a démarche was a bad thing, but you could have a positive démarche. You could say, please help us with this. And we're trying to build this norm of better international cooperation against shared threats. We did that. We did that,
23 countries?
Yeah.
Wow.
So we went, and coupled that with our technical outreach. And what that did is within those governments, it raised the priority of this issue. This wasn't just the noise that, you know, you get lots of inquiries.
Right. So it wasn't just, cop
really
to cop or,
and we'll
cert
be willing to work with
right.
you if you have a similar thing. So that kind of, building of more cooperation has been important too.
That's interesting, and I think that raises a whole bunch of, I think, interesting questions, because we are actually, we, the United States, are in less good situation to deal with botnets than many other countries. ISPs are reluctant to act against their customers, and they're reluctant to share information with the government because it may be deemed a violation of privacy. When you say we'll work with you, it would have to be some kind of law enforcement. There would have to be some law enforcement determination. These particular machines are being used in a way that violates the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, wouldn't it?
Well, it could be. But, I mean, if you're telling a country you have compromised computers that are essentially launching these attacks against the U.S., each country's laws are somewhat different and their
right.
abilities are somewhat different. So our request is use the capabilities you can. And it could be a simple...
As a phone call.
As a phone call. And saying, you know, to an ISP saying, you know, you may not know this, but you have this coming from your system. And a lot of the ISPs have terms of service that allow them to take action if they want to. So, or it could be a law enforcement or some other kind of action. So it depends on the country you're dealing with.
And what was the overall impact of all the
I thought it was very positive. I mean, look, this is an ongoing thing. We're still in the beginning of a trail on dealing with a lot of these cyber threats. And these are, you know, denial of service attacks are one kind of threat. Another is intrusions when you're right. stealing information, and that's a different kind of threat. But I think it was very positively received by a lot of these countries, and it also helped the more technical entities in these countries get more visibility and also get more priority.
Right, and I can see how that I can see a lot of good diplomatic payoff. I'm not sure I see a long-term technical payoff in this.
Well, I think, you know, there are some countries which are still institution buildings. So they
yes.
may not have a cert, so they may not have that
so
institution.
So this inspires them to go
it
out and do something.
Inspires that, and it makes it clear that this is a higher level issue than just a technical issue, which is important. I mean, that, you know, one of the things we've seen in my office also is in terms of the development of this as a policy issue around the world, we were the first office ever that was created in a foreign ministry to deal with these issues at a senior level. Since our office was created 3 years ago, there are now about 14 different counterparts around the world, including China and Russia, but Germany and the UK and Japan and Korea and more coming. So we saw
that at DHS. You know, the creation of DHS here led to the creation of something like DHS in a number of countries that dealt with us regularly, just because it was a lot easier to have somebody they could say, yes, this is the counterpart of DHS, than to leave their existing structure the same.
Yeah, and frankly, I think it's helped in a lot of the international debate when you're seeing these things come up in a number of different international forums to have people who are trying to work within their own governments to pull it together. I'll give you an example. Yes, there are diplomats that go to a lot of forums that discuss various important foreign policy issues. But a lot of the issues in this space also take place in technical communities, whether it be, you know, in the ITU or the IETF or other
mm-hmm.
places. And they would send ministries for their communication ministries. But now, more and more, they're lashing up and saying, well, there's foreign policy aspects to this
right.
that you need to deal with.
Well, that's, and that does make sense, because the communications folks have a very relatively narrow slice of this.
Important but narrow, that's
yeah.
right.
So just to go back to the botnet attacks, I seem to remember a debate that I won't ask you to talk about it, about whether a more direct approach, actually going in and sending code to the machines, which we knew, and who in many cases we had control or could control the communication system, in which we could just send them code that says, please uninstall yourself so that you'll stop attacking me. There was a debate, according to the press, about whether that was consistent with international law. Obviously, you went with a démarche approach, at least in part. But what is the international, the State Department's view of our authority to send code to a foreign computer that is attacking us that would neutralize the attack?
So, you know, I think in all these things, we have to be, consider issues of sovereignty, issues of international law. These are all evolving contact, are all evolving discussions. But I would say in this case, it's always our preference to try to first use law enforcement and technical channels and diplomatic channels as we look at these threats. And I won't go beyond that right
now. No, and I can imagine that if the the use of code is subject to an unable or unwilling to resolve analysis, that asking first and then seeing that it didn't work might give a basis for a determination that the folks you demarched were unable or unwilling to solve the problem.
Well, and there's also, look, there's technical things that you and I have talked about this in the past where, and I think you've asked in the past, well, why can't companies go out and, you know, try to take care of the threats themselves and hit where they think it's coming from? And part of that is, well, where is it actually coming from? You're likely hitting innocent third-party computers, and companies don't have that kind of information. So that's another complexity.
I will only say that my general view has not been that private companies should go out and hit folks that they think are the source of an attack, but that for sure they should be able to gather information about the people who are directly connected to them and downloading stuff from their system onto machines that may exist someplace else. If you can't pursue that information in real time, you'll probably never catch up with it. You'll never be able to find out where it went, or be able to get it back. And for CSIPs to say, oh, I'm sorry, you know, that might be a crime, is irresponsible. But you're not at CSIPs anymore, so I will not charge you with that. A last question about the botnet attacks. The U.S. government has been enthusiastic about norms in cyber war, cyber attack, and if there's anything that people have agreed ought to be a norm, it's that you ought not to attack somebody else's financial system, and there are plenty of reports that suggest the U.S. has foregone opportunities to attack financial systems as far back as Kosovo. And yet, when you look around the world and say, well, where are the state-sponsored attacks? What do they look like? We've got pretty good evidence that North Korea has attacked South Korean banks, that Iran has attacked U.S. banks. Certainly, even without the attribution, there's no doubt people are attacking financial institutions in attacks that look state-sponsored pretty regularly. What does that say for the existence of norms?
Well, I mean, norms is, obviously one of the core focuses of our work is promoting norms in cyberspace. It was in the international strategy, and existing norms too. We don't need to create whole new norms for cyberspace or a whole new law for cyberspace. One of the key norms we've been advancing, really from the beginning, which may seem simple to you, but it has not been a simple argument, to win, but I think we are certainly trending in that direction, is that international law applies in cyberspace just like it does in the physical world. And there were a number of countries who didn't believe that, believed you need a whole new legal infrastructures for that.
And that until you had it, that there weren't any rules? Is that their principle?
Well, essentially. And so what's happened, though, is within the group of government experts in the UN, the last meeting they had, they reached a conclusion. This is 15 countries, including the U.S., China, and Russia, and India and others, which reached the conclusion that international law does, in fact, including international humanitarian law, with the law of armed conflict, applies to cyberspace. You have the UN Human Rights Committee say that you have the same rights online as you do offline. Again, that seems obvious to us, but not really to others. So those are the kind of more general norms we've been promoting. Now, you know, those kinds of norms, international law applying, are pretty high level. And so the question is, and something we've been pursuing, and this is an ongoing pursuit, is what are the kinds of peacetime norms that you can promote of things that countries should be doing and refrain from doing? And that's an ongoing discussion. And we talked about some of those more generally in the past, but that's still evolving.
Yeah, I would have thought that if the Russians and the Chinese really understood us as well as they should, they would have seen that applying international law to cyber attacks is very much in their interest, because they're going to ignore it, and then we're going to have 600 JAGs passing on every downloaded piece of code.
Well, I think creating an environment where people understand that international law applies, and then the question is how it applies, and that's what this next GGE is going to take up, which begins meeting in July, and so that will be one of the key aspects there going
on. Sorry,
forward.
What's a GG?
Group of Government Experts. Okay. It's a UN group under what's called the First Committee, which does conflict issues. And it's 15 countries now. It's 20 countries this year. They expanded it. Who will deal with this, taking forward this issue of how does international law apply? And also another key issue which we've been focused on. So, you know, yes, there are differences, policy differences between the U.S. and some other countries, and, you know, in terms of how we look at the internet. But we also need to do something where we're building practical measures between countries to make sure that we avoid the risk of miscalculation, misperception, and inadvertent escalation in cyberspace. So one of the big efforts of my team, including my deputy, Michelle Markov, who's been doing this for many, many years, is to advocate for cyber confidence-building measures, to transparency, cooperative, and stability measures in cyberspace, which we've, you know, done. We had bilateral ones with Russia. We've done something within the Organization of Security and Cooperation in Europe just this past December. We had the first landmark, multilateral confidence building measures. These are not rocket science. This is like exchanging information about, you know, how your governments are organized or your national strategies or having points of contact between the two countries that you can call in case of an emergency or to have search channels that would communicate with each other, or like in the botnet case, cooperating against third-party threats. So I
seem to remember long ago there was a suggestion that there was the equivalent of the hotline between the U.S. and Russia that was going to include communications about
cyber. In fact, that's true. I mean, one of the things that was announced back at the last G8 summit last year was the creation of certain bilateral cyber confidence building measures that include using the NERC Nuclear Risk Reduction Center, which is a data line, essentially, between the U.S. and Russia to deal with cyber incidents originating or seen to be originating from one country or the other against the territory of the other, and then also having an actual phone hotline and then CERT communication. So those are clearly confidence building measures. And the same thing in the OSCE were a broader set of confidence building measures. And the work continues there. And we're also looking at Asian Regional Forum to do some of that work. With the Chinese, I chair our working group, our all of government working group with China. We've had a couple of meetings so far. And with that group, we focus both on the threats, including the theft of intellectual property, but also how we can try to build more transparency between the two sides to make sure that we're, you know, we're cooperating where we need to, and that we understand how each other is organized.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to get into the details of this, but surely, I mean, we were launching a kind of campaign that in which even the president was pointing to Chinese cyber espionage aimed at stealing commercial secrets and really objecting to the very noisy, very intrusive Chinese campaigns. They're not any less noisy or any less intrusive now, but for the last year, every time the U.S. government brings up cyber espionage, the Snowden leaks become a major talking point. Is that still true? What's been the impact of the Snowden leaks on U.S. ability to raise some of these issues?
Well, we still clearly raise this with the Chinese and others. We've been unabashed about raising this as a real concern, and the president has made clear that there is a vast difference between collecting intelligence to protect our citizens and the kind of intelligence collection that's meant to benefit commercial entities, which we do not do, our commercial sector. So, and we don't think countries should do, quite frankly. And we've been very clear about that.
Do you think that's a norm?
I think it is. I mean, I think that's...
Really? Because there's nobody, with the possible exception of the Brits and the Canadians, who share our view.
I would dispute that. I think more would share that view, especially as more and more countries are targeted and they see what's happening. And I think that's a norm that I think we want to continue to encourage. That we want to say that, you know, when you're taking intellectual property for purposes of benefiting your commercial sector, that that's off limits. And I think that's something we're going to continue to work on. You know, the other thing I'd say is that, you know, some countries have tried to take advantage of the disclosure issue to advance their more repressive view of the internet. And what I've seen there, though, is that a lot of the countries we deal with, allies and other countries, I think, recognize the core things that are at stake. I mean, are you going to have an internet that is balkanized? I can't really use balkanized in the States, but I guess fragmented.
Sorry.
Or the splinter net, as people have called it. Or are you going to have this more open platform? And, you know, we're not, you know, as the president also said, you know, you don't want to target, we do not target people for their political views or to repress their human rights. And this is something, that we need to continue to push, and our allies and others need to push on the value of having an open internet.
So if I were the Chinese, I'd go around saying, we'll show you how to build a sovereign internet, just the way we have. And that, countries like Turkey might find that, or Brazil might find that attractive. It would have law enforcement advantages to them. This is going to be a long-term fight, isn't it?
Well, that's why I go back to, you know, the arguments, one of the chief arguments that we advance, and the OECD and others have advanced, is the value of having this open, multi-stakeholder-driven internet rather than a closed, government-controlled internet, whether it be one government or intergovernmental. You don't want an intergovernmental institution running the internet, because you wouldn't have the advancements that we have. You'd have a lot more focus on content and other issues. And a great example of that is Brazil just hosted
Net
Mundial conference I was down at in Sao Paulo. It was actually interesting. I went from there to Tallinn, a very normally traveled trek between Sao Paulo and Tallinn, for then the Freedom Online Coalition meeting. But in the Sao Paulo meeting, a lot of these issues were at stake. What is the future of internet governance? Do we want to have this open, inclusive system that is driven not just by countries, but by the private sector and civil society, where countries don't get to call the final shot? And what are the implications of that? And, you know, with some rare exceptions, the resounding message that came out of Sao Paulo from all the stakeholders who were there, and there were 800 there, and there are many web portals that were tied in as well, was that the multi-stakeholder view of internet governance, all the different stakeholders really calling the shots in this policy area, was the one that should prevail. And I think that is important, because that's not just a U.S.-centric or Europe-centric or Japan-centric view, but a lot of the Global South is now, I think, embracing this because they can see that this is good for their economic development, too.
Well, that would be a positive development, and probably is in their interest, but they've been blinded in part by a sense that, anything the U.S. likes is probably bad for them. And now that the U.S. has said, you want ICANN, you can have it.
That's not quite what the U.S. said. What the U.S. has said is that we really do believe in the multi-stakeholder system, and we're willing to have the multi-stakeholder system decide what the future of this IANA contract is with ICANN. There is a lot of, I think, especially between governments that have a different view of this world, who like to just paint the internet as being a U.S.-controlled thing, and it only benefits the U.S. That, frankly, isn't true. And that's, we really do believe, and we put our bet in the multi-stakeholder system, which doesn't give the government the final say, even in the U.S. It gives everyone a stake.
Yeah. There are lots of reasons to think that ICANN is not an ideal system, but it's hard to think of one that the government's ran that would be better.
Yeah, and we have been from the beginning, and my colleague Larry Strickling over at the Commerce Department has been working to strengthen the existing multi-stakeholder institutions, making sure that they're more inclusive and accountable. And that's an ongoing work, and we want to make sure that both countries and other stakeholders from around the world play in these as we go forward in this. But that doesn't mean throwing these institutions out and then trying to create a government-controlled system, which would have, I think, huge negative effects, both for the growth of technology and also in terms of just repression and keeping people from using an open internet like they can now.
So that one of the, and this I know we need to let you go, but one of the big drivers toward a much more divided internet is the frustration of law enforcement. If you're a Brazilian investigator and two Brazilians are engaged in kidnapping and talking to the victim, who's also Brazilian, and they're using Yahoo Mail to do that, you can't do an investigation. Indeed, you can't even do a wiretap anymore because SSL, which has been implemented by all of these companies, makes it impossible to gather that information even if you have a suspect. You have to go to Silicon Valley and ask them to give it to you, and that means going through the MLAT process by and large. If we don't fix the MLAT process, that implies it's broken, but I think it is. If we don't fix it, they're going to demand that the data all be stored in Brazil. What do you think we can do about MLATs?
So, I mean, I think that countries are beginning to see that a data localization requirement doesn't really make economic sense, and it doesn't really make policy sense either. And you simply can't replicate that around the globe and have every company storing everything everywhere, and that causes some problems. And you're quite right that in terms of investigation, we want to make sure that people can investigate crimes, and we're committed to working, and certainly near and dear to my heart as a former prosecutor, working with other countries to do this. And this is one of the places, I mean, the Computer Crime and Intellectual Property Section has been doing a lot of good work in this area, working with others in justice to try to streamline the process, the 24/7 network for high-tech crime, which is now over 60 countries they run. And so, despite your comment earlier about CSIPs, I'd say they're a wonderful group and they've done a great job.
They've got this one blind spot, is what I would say.
What I would say is that one of the things the president said in his recent speech was the need to update and modernize and streamline our mutual legal assistance, process. Recognizing that if it takes a long time, that often causes some of these moves toward data localization.
That has to be the first time the president has said anything about multilateral.
Well, I don't know. I haven't gone back and looked at it, but it was an important part of his speech and his remarks. And there are a couple things that are being done already on that. As I said, the president said he would be devoting resources to this and making it a priority. The administration has requested $24 million in funding for this effort. And part of it is strengthening the ability of the Justice Department and giving it the resources to actually respond quicker to these. Part of it is also working with foreign countries and foreign law enforcement because, Stuart, I've been doing this for a long, long time, and there's still a lot of requests that come in that frankly don't give you the data you need. They say, give me everything you have on this IP address. And, we can't really respond to that, nor can another country. You don't know what the crime is. You don't know what the issues are. So that kind of capacity building and work, which has been a lot of good work, particularly by DOJ in the past. Part of this is to continue to work on that education process. So it's both strengthening our capabilities to react more quickly, but it's also working with the other countries. And it is a priority for us.
Michael, any questions for Chris? I know you worked with Chris pretty closely in past.
Back in the day, yes. Michael and I, back when you were at the FBI.
Yeah, gosh, a long time ago now.
Back then it was, I think when I was doing the prosecution of the, what turned out to be the 14-year-old Canadian named, with the moniker Mafia Boy for the denial of service attacks back in the early 2000 actually.
Yeah, back then, I mean, the biggest criticism we got was that, we were just trying to invent a new threat, and it wasn't real. It was just 14-year-olds like that, and now the biggest criticism the government gets is that it's not doing enough. So times fortunately change.
Yes, it is, it is interesting that, I don't think there's been moves before to make cybersecurity a priority and to make cyber a priority in the U.S. government and around the world, and there's been a little bit of a sinusoidal wave on this. I think this is clearly here to stay now. I think it's internalized. When I go to – there years ago, I'd go to very senior – and, Mike, you've done this too – go to very senior government discussions, and people are reading their talking points that someone gave them. That's no longer true. The level of engagement of very senior people within the government and on this issue – And the ability to understand why this is such a big deal, including first and foremost the president, who has made this a real priority in the U.S. from the day he took office. I think that's really been a marked change.
Well, all right. Thanks to both of you. Close, we usually give our guests and the other people on the panel a chance to talk about anything they think the audience ought to know about, travel, speeches, books. I don't think you've got a book out. And I hesitate to ask for your travel schedule because we'll be here for another half hour. But is there anything in particular you think the audience ought to know about that's coming up?
I think there are a number of things that are coming up. I mean, one of the things, as I said, Stuart, earlier, is that on the international stage, these issues are coming up constantly in a variety of different forms. Some major things that will be coming up soon, and we just had a couple major points, is the launch of this next group of government experts in June or end of July. We have a number of our bilats scheduled with Germany and Berlin with, we're going to have another meeting with China in the summer. There is something called the Stockholm Internet Forum that Carl Bildt is running in May, and a lot of these issues will be discussed there as well. And then there is, and this is a little far in advance, but in April of next year, there will be the next installment of the conferences that start in London, and the Dutch will be hosting this in The Hague. And interestingly, their new cyber coordinator, Uri Rosenthal, is their former foreign minister. So I may have been the first, but he's the most august. And they're trying to make this like the other ones to look at all of the different issues, all these baskets of issues in cyberspace, and really move the ball forward. So this is not a space, as you know, where there's a paucity of activity. And there's many, many things.
Maybe a paucity of progress, but there's not a paucity of activity.
I honestly think there's been a lot of progress. I mean, this movement in terms of endorsing international law, the movement in terms of really coming up with practical confidence-building measures on the security side. There's been a lot of advancement in new countries signing on to the Budapest Convention for Cybercrime. Japan confirmed it recently. Australia confirmed it recently. Some of the smaller countries are also now joining it. And our policy has been, if you can't join it, at least have laws that will be
that look like it.
And many countries are pursuing that, so that's been very good. I think the declarations we get out of NotMundial and the Freedom Online Coalition about the importance of these issues, the ball is rolling in the right direction. So I'm even as a former prosecutor, I'm a generally optimistic person, and I think there's a lot to be optimistic about.
Okay.
Even with the threats we have out there.
Michael, any speaking engagements, new articles that you'd like to promote?
No, I'm staying mute for the next few weeks.
All right. No trips to the Johnstown Flood Museum that you'd like to highlight?
Not till later in the summer, and I'm still waiting for the Supreme Court to take my taser case.
I'm still waiting for my $5 when they don't summarily reverse it. So we will continue that. We have a bet on his a Supreme Court petition. I've got two speeches coming up later this week. Thursday I'll be doing the 2014 Legal Frontiers in Digital Media Conference at the Computer History Museum in Mountain View, California. And then on Friday, fly down to L.A. for the ISSA L.A. Information Security Summit. One of them includes, I think the second one includes the DNI's Civil Liberties and Privacy Protection Officer, Alex Joel, who listeners will remember from a past podcast. Thank you again, Chris. Thanks, Michael. This has been episode 19 of the Steptoe Cyber Law Podcast, brought to you by Steptoe & Johnson. We hope you'll join us next week for insights into the latest events in technology, security, privacy, and government.